You know, they say we're no smarter than yeast. They say we'll all soon be deceased. But we'll find in the rubble the end of the trouble. Any day now we shall be released. That's why I listen to Extinction Radio. Hee-haw!
Hello, listeners out in Extinction Radio land. It's Peter Melton joining you again. And recently I had a fascinating connection with a young man who's been out and about around the world dealing with folks who are actually living through this unraveling of our climate, our status quo, our business as usual, as he's gone to the places where these storms have hit the hardest. And so I wanted to bring him to you to get a different perspective of all of this. So welcome, Alex Londos.
Thank you. Thank you, Peter. So my name is Alex Londos. I'm the owner of Advanced Disaster Relief. It's a company that I started a few years ago. I want to first talk about some of my experience, background, and education, and what got me to this point to be in this place to directly help people that have been impacted and affected by superstorms and natural disasters around the world in connection to not only just normal natural disasters, but man-made disasters and superstorms, in different countries around the world. So my name is Alex Londos. I started as a freelance photojournalist, taking some pictures and some images and doing some basic journalism projects when I was younger, before I got a job at Channel 2 News in Reno, Nevada. I think I was 20, 21 years old. I was really fortunate that I worked my way up from the prompter operator to working the audio board and eventually working in the newsroom. I would go out on field shoots and work with politicians and filming protests and parades and different video packages working at this TV station. I worked there for a year, and then I got some experience to later get a job at SINCAT Government Access, which was a governmental TV station, and I was always at city council meetings and doing a lot of political stuff as well as just things around the community. So after that, I got more interested in doing freelance photojournalism. My very first story was when I saw a forest fire in Reno. I had enough time to get my camera and my gear and equipment together, and I went and covered it, and I got some incredible video that I sold to the stations. Since that point, I started covering a lot of forest fires because I lived in Reno and there's fire season every year. So I got some experience as a, driving around my truck, looking for little things to film and sell to the news stations. It wasn't until Hurricane Katrina affected New Orleans in 2005 that I felt confident and prepared that I can accomplish a big mission. So I packed and loaded up my Ford Bronco in Santa Cruz, California, and I drove from Santa Cruz all the way to New Orleans. I made it into the region, I think 7 to 10 days after the superstorm affected that region. And it was really rewarding that I was able to drive street to street, passing out canned food and bottled water and directly helping people that have been affected by the storm.
And this was that, Alex, yeah. Real quick, this was 2005, so this is 12 years ago. So how old were you then? You're in your mid-20s.
I was 25, actually. So I was young to be by myself in New Orleans and see this and experience this. And it was an amazing experience to be able to give someone a bottle of water or some canned food or some of the supplies that I brought from thousands of miles away from states over all the way to California and be able to get into the place to directly help people before the military and government arrived. And it was at that point that I realized that we don't have everything under control. You might think that disasters, aid organizations go in, there's a military or the UN or the National Guard, but they're not. No doubt disasters are under control. There's always suffering. There's always hunger. There's always disease and or violence or different situations where people need immediate medical attention. And I don't think I've ever seen a disaster where it had the right amount of resources that people were able to safely recover within a moderate amount of time. So at that point, I really wanted to get more involved in emergency services, and I didn't know where to start. So I started with Red Cross. I started taking a lot of the Red Cross courses, which got me some basic training and got me a little bit of medical experience. And I do some volunteer work through them. I continue to take classes at Cabrillo College. At this point, I have 84 units, and I took some courses in renewable energy and resources, solar technology, medical training classes, emergency medical response. I actually took a course in nuclear, chemical, biological first responder, hazmat first responder. I took the EMT course and different classes that I felt would benefit my career, not only as a journalist, but being able to directly help people in being like a hybrid journalist, first responder, just from what I was able to accomplish in New Orleans. So around 2007, 2008, I started covering more disasters, more forest fires. I started expanding my portfolio to floods and landslides, got away from filming anything that didn't help humanity or the environment. I stopped doing anything that was, you know, parades or shows and concerts, and started really focusing on environmental impact and things that could raise awareness to the impact that we're causing on the environment. So I had my first major disaster, which was, I think, 2013, when the superstorm Haiyan, the local name is Yolanda, affected the Philippine area. And that's extremely high winds and storm surge, and it devastated that whole region. And I was, I felt that I had enough training to make it into the region by myself and be an independent first responder, and then document the disaster at the same time. So that was one of my major major disasters. In between the news courses that I've taken, the Cabrillo courses, and all of my training and education and background experience, I was also able to fit in the CERT course, which gave me additional training that I learned how to do search and rescue and body recovery and put out fires and work in teams. So they actually had different types of volunteers and aid organizations in the Philippines that I was able to attach myself as a single resource and help them out after this this disaster, because I now had the experience to work along with different crews. So sometimes I would be doing search and rescue. Sometimes I would be treating medical wounds. For a few days, I did body recovery and I helped remove dead bodies that were trapped under the debris. Other days, I was transporting medical supplies and aid to people that needed clean water and they needed food. So that was another one of my major missions. So throughout all of this, I've been able to sell my footage to the news networks, which helps on some of my missions. I've made national news several times. I've been on CNN, NBC, CBS, ABC, KSBW, a lot of major news networks, Associated Press, World News, made it on Philippine National News. I've also sold my photographs and my stories to a lot of newspapers, as far as the Santa Cruz Sentinel, the Reno News and Review, Reno Gazette Journal. I've been on several radio stations, and I'm trying to get this information out to people that it helps with awareness, how to be prepared for disasters, how to respond to disasters. I try to promote people taking some Red Cross courses and the CERT course, taking the EMT course, basic first responder courses. And so throughout all of these missions, I've now created a really impressive journalistic portfolio and been able to directly help people in different places around the world. So there was the Hurricane Katrina disaster that I showed up for the aftermath. I've also I covered Hurricane Isaac that affected the New Orleans area, Hurricane Gustav that affected New Orleans. So I've been through those two hurricanes. I was also in New York during Superstorm Sandy. I've been tornado chasing. I've been through, I don't know, 30 or 40 forest fires. I've covered a lot of landslides, a lot of flooding events. I was able to make it to Ghana during the peak of the Ebola outbreak and work with the international community there. I also went to the Nepal epicenter earthquake, made it into the region, treated medical patients, and worked in that region for a month by myself, doing everything that I could to help the community rebuild and get back on their feet. And then recently I went to Iraq and I helped out the Peshmerga military. I donated a lot of military supplies. I bought medical supplies from stores in the region, took taxis to Syrian refugee camps and clinics, and directly transported these supplies. And I was able to be a positive example to a lot of other people that we have to work together to help one another. And we have to transition into a caring society. Otherwise, our society is going to continue to collapse, and it's going to continue to divide the equality gap.
Wow. Wow, I just feel like standing up and applauding a
Thank
young
you.
man who just spent the last, well, 12 or 13 years of your life just out there doing it and right on the edge and daring to document what's going on, but more than just be there with your camera, you know, you're in there with the people who have had their lives completely stripped away. And that's really the fascinating thing right now for me to want to talk to you about here on Extinction Radio is, you know, a lot of times we'll talk about, you know, it's unraveling, things are going to get really bad, the storms are going to get worse, this is going to happen more, this is going to come to a city near you. But you've gone to the cities where it's happened, and wow, what's it like when you land in a devastated area?
So, first off, the thing that motivates me, the thing that drives me, is the same thing that would drive anyone. I see the news. That's what drove me to go to New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, was seeing the devastation, seeing the people suffering, and being inspired to be able to go on my own and directly help. I try to direct my journalism to inspire more people to get involved, to help out, whether it's actually going to regions to help or taking the emergency response courses or directing more funds and resources towards the aid organizations that are on the ground and making a difference. So all of this has been – so it's definitely scary when I go into these situations. It's not – I'm not going with the aid organization. I'm not going with a crew of people. I'm doing this on my own. So I'm figuring out a lot of these situations on my own. I'm trying to work through every obstacle. They are very stressful as far as finding solutions to every one of the challenges that I have. And before a disaster, all I do is focus on getting into that region. I don't think about what I'm going to do once I'm there. I don't think about how I'm going to get out or where I'm going to go. When I flew to Iraq, I didn't even have a hotel room reserved. I didn't even have any contacts. I just flew to Erbil, Iraq, which was 40 miles away from Mosul, and I figured out things once I was there. So Iraq wasn't necessarily the situation in Iraq wasn't necessarily directly related to climate change related events, unless you want to think of the rise in temperatures and increase in hostility. But definitely, I think that Superstorm Haiyan and a lot of the other superstorms around the world, Sandy, there's been direct correlations with climate change and the increase in frequency and intensity of hurricanes around the world. So. Yeah,
right,
I've been
so
closely following.
Take me there. Mm-hmm. Take me into you. You land in the Philippines,
mm-hmm. Okay.
And the hurricane's already been through, right? And just paint the picture for us. You talked about several of the things you
okay.
did, including moving dead bodies and stuff. Take us to what it's like to be around the people.
So first off, to get into the Philippines, there was no flights going in and out of the Philippines. I believe it was like a week, probably a week to 10 days after the superstorm before I got all of my supplies and equipment together. I flew in. I believe I flew into a city called Davao, D-A-V-O, from what I remember. And I had to catch a smaller flight across to one of the other islands, to Lady Island. But there was no commercial airlines going, so I had to just go up to the military and showed them the equipment, showed them my press pass, and asked to get on a flight. So I was originally trying to get into a flight to Tacloban, but that wasn't leaving until later on in the day. And one of the guys that working for the U.S. military said, hey, come on, get on this flight. You can go, you know, it's leaving early. There's just as much destruction. So I get on this plane. It's a military plane. It's a big aircraft. I think I was with the British military, even though the U.S. Set up the plane flights. So I'm on the flight, and I'm going in, and, you know, the aircraft's shaking, and I'm seatbelted in. Everybody's quiet, and everybody just looks scared. So I try to start conversation. I say, hey, guys, so what kind of ground crews do we have? What kind of equipment do we have in the region? What's the situation like in the area we're going? And I'm just trying to get an idea of what's going to happen. The guy looks over at me and he says, are you kidding? We're the first aircraft to land in this area. They haven't seen anybody since, you know, before the hurricane. So I landed and on a airport tarmac that just opened up, and there was a lot of people being held back at the fence with the military. And yeah, there's a lot of adrenaline involved. I feel the adrenaline right now. So I get off the aircraft and I just walk into the city, and I later caught a couple of local taxis and buses and even little scooters to make my way across Lady Island all the way to the epicenter of Tacloban, where the storm surge was as high as 18 feet, where there was boats lifted up out of their harbors. There was dead bodies in the trees and just complete mass destruction, catastrophic destruction. And that's when I look at my first obstacles and I think about what I can do, what my solutions are going to be. And I start networking with people and communities surrounding Tacloban and try to make a difference.
What was that like? So there you are in that town and you see all the destruction and you're trying to get with some people, you're just there by yourself, because mm-hmm. even though you flew in with those other guys, they're doing it their way, and you're just a lone ranger out there saying, I'm hoping to help. How can I help?
Yeah, so communication is a very important key when you're in these situations, and you know, being considerate of people's situation and the devastation that they've gone through. So after talking to some of the locals and passing out some of the supplies and stuff that I carried all in the backpacks and other equipment that I had, I was able to find like a staging area. And after a lot of disasters, there's these staging areas set up, and that's where you might see a freelance photojournalist, you might see some local news crews, you'll see some emergency responses, maybe some police officers or some firefighters, some of the city council and stuff like that. So this one happened to be at the city hall area, you know, the county building area. So I was able to find that, and I networked with a couple aid organizations. And, I'd volunteer with them for a few days, and I'd go off on my own missions on, you know, transporting supplies. And so that was the first part, just getting grounded and seeing who's doing what. And slowly people started trickling in, you know, more resources, more aid, and it started to get more organized. You know, you see the people in the community, resilient communities like the Philippines, starting to clear the roads and move debris out of the roads and starting to get organized. And you just start to see the community clean itself up. And it's
wow.
It's really really impacting to be there and to see the mass suffering and the pain these people have gone through, to see people crying and begging for bottled water, digging through debris for anything they have left over, crying and screaming and looking for loved ones and family members, to see just cuts and injuries and hearing people's stories about, I've heard so many stories in the Philippines about how the flood water rose and they went to the second story and then it rose higher and they went to the, you know, to the roof and they hung on and they lost family members in the water, how they swim through the debris and their legs got cut up from the debris in the storm surge. And you hear these stories and it makes me sick that more people don't help in these disasters when we just leave people suffering. And I sometimes I can't even watch the news. Otherwise, I'll do everything that I can to jump in a plane and go help people. And I wish that we did. I wish there was more caring people so we could transition into a society that's safe and
And like these storms, you never know where they're going to hit, you know.
Right.
And we're very unprepared, obviously,
mm-hmm.
For even a power outage, let alone a big storm hitting places. And so I know you do these disaster relief packages.
Mm-hmm,
tell us a little bit about that part of what you do.
So after covering so many of these disasters around the world, after taking the EMT course, after going backpacking, hiking, camping, summiting Mount Whitney several years back, learning how to pack light and what you need and what's important and what's going to help you to get through the next few days, I came up with my international survival kit, and I designed it to bridge the gap in between when there's a disaster and more help arrives. The Philippines is what inspired me to create this, because people would come up to me and they would say, hey, do you have any bandages? I'd pull them out of one of my cargo pants pockets. Hey, do you have any antibiotic ointment? I'd pull that up. Do you have you know, a pencil to write down this aid organ? Just different things that they would ask me for. So I created my kit help alleviate suffering and malnutrition. At the same time, there's a Mylar blanket for warmth. There's matches for to cook food, or also for warmth. I designed it the best that I could to be lightweight and to be able to hand a person one package. You could put it in your car, you can put it in your boat, you can keep it in your office. It weighs about, I think, a pound and a half. There's a Band-Aid, a spoon, a protein bar, a little notepad. Rubber gloves are extremely important after a disaster. Earthquake, they're important to a certain extent, but after a superstorm, there's so many infectious diseases, there's so many, so much chemicals, and just about everything will get you sick. So rubber gloves are important. There's water purification tablets, a face mask. There's a little packet of salt. There's a candle, Q-tips. Medical bandage, sugar for diabetes, trash bag for a trash bag, rain jacket where people can put their belongings. I tried to design it the best that each item serves multiple purposes, and I have it on my website. I may still have it on eBay.
Tell us the website while you're on it.
My website is advanceddisasterrelief.com, and then that's my international survival kit. And honestly, I kind of put this project on hold, the survival kit, because I started focusing on my book. I started writing my book, A Resource Guide to Solve Urgent Global Issues, back in 2008 when I started really getting involved in emergency response. I really started studying climate change and the direction our society was heading. Started studying, the greenhouse gases and the increase in parts per million and the melting glacial ice caps and all of the potential disasters of the future, and how the feedback loops were starting to unravel that are still unraveling today and taking us in exponentially in a negative direction. So I started writing my book, and honestly, the last 6 months, the last year, I've been my survival kit's kind of been on the back burner. I have some of them, I still make them, but my book's been my main focus because I'm trying to get this information out. I'm trying to talk about emergency preparedness, people taking the CERT course, people getting off the video games and stop watching sports as often, and stop watching TV and just start focusing on sustainability, investing their money towards renewable energy and resources, buy an electric car, voting with their dollar in organic food, and all of this stuff that I wanted to get out of my head, I directed towards my book.
Gotcha.
And it's now
gotcha. So those are obviously important
mm-hmm.
aspects
right.
of steps, but something mm-hmm. you said earlier too about
yeah.
about community, about what is community like in those areas where they get all swept away, where they have the disaster, and how is it people coming together, people working together? Tell us a little bit more about how it felt to be in the middle of that in here the last few minutes we have today.
I think that different areas and communities work together in different ways. We saw that the people in Japan, how well they worked together after the tsunami caused by the earthquake, how they were returning safes of money, and there wasn't a lot of looting, if any. There wasn't any violence. It was just they worked together very well. The Philippines also worked together really well, although there was some looting and there was some negative criminal activity that slowed down the potential progress that the communities could have made. But after the first few weeks, people really started working together. They started assembling lines to where they had passed debris to one another. They started the initial traumatic shock was over, and they realized that there's nothing else they can do at that point. The grief was over, and they had to rebuild. They had to clean up. They had to work together to rebuild their community.
So many people suffering and so many people deep in grief and completely lost everything mm-hmm. That was their lives. And yet, I think you said it there was nothing else to do. This is all there is to do, is start to clean up and see what we can come up with. And have you been in these places, because the storms hit and it's on the news when all the destruction's happening, and then you never see it again.
Right.
Have you been back to places that you went to when it was happening to see how the follow-up is?
A good example is that I was in New Orleans a few weeks after Hurricane Katrina, and then going back to cover Hurricane Gustav and Hurricane Isaac and still seeing some of the cars in the same spots, still seeing trash and debris in the same places where there was storm surge or where stuff was destroyed. So I think it depends on the economy and people taking individual initiative to rebuild their community and to clean up their area and their own property and what is their responsibility from having trash or debris on their property. So some places I feel have been more resilient. I don't know if all the areas in New Orleans have been necessarily 100% resilient, and I'm not sure about Japan. I saw amazing progress in the Philippines after the superstorm, and in Nepal after the earthquake. I saw people rebuild within a matter of weeks and really take the initiative to help each other and to move past the earthquake and know that they're going to rebuild their community better than it was and look to the future and not be depressed and set back by the past. So Nepal set a great example in Nepal and how well the people organized and really
awesome.
Great communities.
Thank you. What an amazing story. What an amazing way to express yourself during these times of daunting challenges and to put yourself out there. You're an inspiration, Alex, to anyone who could hear you or hear your story. That is just beautiful. I so appreciate you putting it out, putting your word out, being out there and active on Facebook, daring people to see things differently and look at themselves and what they could do and all the inspiration that you've done. So give us your website one more time.
My website is at Advanced Disaster Relief, and I've been most active on Facebook, on social media. It's very convenient for me to do a post. It gets my message out that I'm trying to, what projects I'm working on and what I'm trying to portray. Websites are a little bit harder to upkeep, especially on a mobile smartphone when you're out in the field, but Facebook's been a really great social media networking platform that I've taken full advantage of.
Spell your name. Spell your name for everybody so they can check you out on Facebook.
So it's Alex Londos, but my first name is spelled slightly different than the normal way. So it's A-L-E-K-Z, and my last name is Londos. That's L-O-N-D-O-S. And I'm not using the profile with my bulletproof vest anymore. I don't know why that's still up. It's the other one. I think I'm tornado chasing in the picture. With a lot of gear and equipment on. So, that's my Facebook, and people can contact me through there. I have an intern that's responding back to my overwhelming responses. She's working on her environmental science degree, and she's happy to write back anybody that wants to communicate through Facebook.
Great. Well, Alex, thank you so much, and keep on keeping on with your beautiful, passionate support of those in need and helping folks to dare to be prepared at least a little bit for the challenges that are likely headed our way. Thank you very much for joining us on Extinction Radio.
Yeah, thank you, Peter.
Don't come. I'm sick of government handed down. No politician is coming around. Government promises all around. All they do is let us down. Comes the black game from the sky. When the rain comes, they wanna keep us dry. When the
I'm so pleased to welcome to our show today Lisa White. Lisa is an intuitive guide and a real key member of our community, and she specializes in very intriguing topics like archetypical astrology, and she's an intuitive, and she really aims to focus on an empowered and authentic life and likes to share her gift with others. And she's a really wonderful support in our community. And as you all know, she has Walk in the Mud, and she also has a regular spot on Extinction Radio. So with great pleasure, Lisa, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Jennifer. It's great to be here. It's nice to be interviewed instead of doing my segment, so this will be a lot of fun.
Yeah, we're turning the tables, aren't we? Well,
everybody
gets interviewed, and you know, you've got such an intriguing story, and it's really a story of transformation and spirituality and contending with climate change in the most catastrophic, you know, time that humanity's ever yet to face. So, you know, you really aim to be more flexible, to be more resilient and more connected, and share that humanitarian human love with the community and with those you work with. So could you tell us a little bit about your work?
Sure. Well, basically, my process started about 2006 when I my life started falling apart. And it's kind of like what we're going through collectively right now. And so I went through a divorce and everything and I wanted to find a way to control it. And so I found astrology, and I thought, okay, if I can figure myself out, I'll fix it all and it won't have to fall apart and I'll be all good. But so that's how I entered my path in astrology. And I found a teacher named Robert Ojado, who is down in Boulder near you. And he taught me astrology using intuition and archetypes. And so all the planets and constellations have different archetypal energies. And so when I'm looking at a client, I can use my intuition. So I get a feel of the soul coming through, as well as their archetypal programming and makeup. So that's kind of how I counsel people. It helps us find a way to be authentic and self-accepting and to see a bigger picture. And so that was my journey. And then along the way, I started becoming more sensitive to spirits on the other side. So I've added mediumship to my toolbox. And I'm also a Reiki master teacher as well.
Oh my God. Well, you've really had an adventure. You know, you're a seeker and you're a seer and you're an explorer. And also, we're on the forefront of this bleeding awareness about abrupt climate change. And you and I have been in the same community for a couple of years now. And we've both very much awakened to the fact that we're in a time of abrupt climate change, that we're most probably looking at full extinction for all species on Earth, practically speaking, and that we're in a time of falling and demise. And, you know, to be a seeker and a spiritually connected person in light of climate change, can you talk to us about that?
Mm-hmm. Well, and in my path of seeking, I happened to come along to find Michael Rupert's work in 2011. And so I was learning astrology and doing all sorts of spiritual work and learning as much as I could. And all of a sudden I came across his work and fell down the rabbit hole by watching Collapse. And so I found Carolyn Baker's work through his website. And I wanted to see how the two combined, because to me, what we're going through is a spiritual experience. It's not just an ecological one. It's not just an economic one. It is a dark night. And as a collective dark night, we transform. And so through destruction comes creation. And I feel that a lot of what we're going through is part of our evolution on a soul level, if we can't see it on the physical plane. If there is extinction, where does the soul go? How do we evolve? And I feel like this situation collectively is a catalyst for that evolution.
I agree. And, you know, we are looking at a time of mass extinction, and of course it's going to bring up questions of our mortality and all these things. So, you know, with this, I'd like to dive into a few things that I was thinking about. Recently, I listened to an interview that you did with Nick of Relief Analysis, and I was really intrigued with it. It was a great interview. God, I mean, doesn't he have a great podcast? I love Nick. Absolutely.
And he's such a humanitarian and sees the bigger picture too.
He's a great soul. He really is. He is a humanitarian. He's a very giving person. And, you know, this is a proper orientation for an advanced soul in the time of demise. And, you know, we're seeing all sorts of, you know, plays enacting before our eyes, mostly at the political level. But what I'd like to talk with you about is dive into some of your astrology work. I am very interested in astrology as well. And I was really intrigued with your whole conversation with Nick that dealt with the fact that we've got Pluto in Capricorn right now, and Pluto is the great revealer, and Pluto went into Capricorn in 2008. Of course, we almost lost the entire economic system. It almost all crumbled in 2008. And in 2008, that's when, you know, the Arctic, like, remember September of 2007, the Arctic was at the small, that it had just taken a huge chunk out of it, and it was like a great amount of ice had melted in September. You know, Pluto is the great revealer, and it's a time of awakening, and this is a time of reckoning and assessment and recapitulation and reflection and understanding and mourning. You know, mourning and transformation. I mean, it's like the phoenix. We're burning up. We're facing our demise. We're crumbling. Everything we see is crumbling, and yet we're going to transform somehow. So this is kind of some things I see, and I'd like you to talk about this whole concept of Pluto and Capricorn, and it's going to stay there. You know, it's such a slow planet. I think it takes like 248 years to go once around the sun. So, you know, these signs, you know, they're 12 signs. It takes a great deal of time. I think Pluto's going to come out of Capricorn in 2023 or 24. So, you know, it's a whole grind when it kind of just kind of works its way through that sign and all that Capricorn stands for in a structural sense and things like that. So could you dive into this a little bit?
Sure. And, you know, Pluto is such a slow, it's a collective planet, and we have other collective planets going into play as well. But it's a slow-moving, thorough cycle, and we're only halfway through. And some people might think that since we're only halfway through, we're almost, you know, it's going to be uphill from there and it's all be downhill from there. It's going to be great. But usually with Pluto, it just keeps going. It's going to make us look at our shadow. It's going to make us deconstruct systems and in order to be reconstructed. It's kind of a wrecking ball, and it'll be thorough all the way through 23-24. So we're just in it for the long haul. And with my clients, I try to teach them to pace themselves and learn how to let go. And so basically the cycle, we have Pluto, and Pluto is more of an energy of the shadow, what's in our unconscious. It is the wrecking ball. It's going to deconstruct things so that we can rebuild them, and it will get rid of what's not necessary. And it is transforming. It's about death and rebirth. And so you're diving down into the depths of our shadows. It's not, you know, we've become so one-sided in our spiritual world, especially in this culture of happiness and trying to be positive, that Pluto is kind of required for us to see that life is about both and. And so we have Pluto in Capricorn, and Capricorn's about our systems. It's about our government, our economic systems, education, healthcare. It's about all of those structures that we have taken for granted. And basically, they're out of date, and we are running on an old program. And so on an evolutionary basis, Pluto is kind of, it's kind of a collective evolution. And Pluto's coming in to make us look at these systems so that we can examine them and see what's no longer working, or to totally wreck the whole thing so something new can be rebuilt. And so we're clinging to the old systems. And Pluto's also showing us the shadow sides of those systems. And, you know, look at our government. It's quite apparent that the shadow is now running the U.S. And so we don't go to the shadow willingly, and we don't look at things that we don't want to look at willingly. So it has to be thrown up in our face. And so that's what I think we're seeing with our political system here in the U.S. at this point. And so, you know, this is a long cycle. And for me, it's just going to be a great time of deconstruction and a time of rebirth, too, at the end of it. We can start looking at it as a creative time as well, because everything is about both and. Yes, we have, you know, deconstruction and things falling apart in the shadow, but that gives us choices. We can start making choices of how we move forward. How do we respond in a humanitarian way, in a way of grace, with compassion, with patience, instead of rebelling and trying to cling to something old? How do we let go? And that's where the grief model is so big right now too, because we're letting go, and we need to grieve those things that we let go of, even if it's for our own good.
That is so fascinating. And, you know, Pluto takes no prisoners. It's very thorough. I mean, you know, there's no way out but through, and that's just what it is. You can go kicking and screaming. It doesn't really matter. You know, it's your choice. So you can resist or not resist, but resistance is futile.
Exactly. Well, with my own personal process, because we'll have a collective process, but then Pluto is affecting each one of us individually. And so when my life started kind of falling apart, it was a heavy Pluto process. Pluto was just hitting my chart hard. And I finally had to just let go and realize the old life that I had built was inauthentic, and it wasn't my essence. It wasn't who I truly was. And I built it based on what culture expected, what my family expected, what, you know, just all these different unconscious things built my old life, and it wasn't authentic. So it had to be totally wrecked, and I had to go down deep and find myself in that and find the gold in that.
And it's always difficult to find the gold in demise and to find the gold in something that you have built in death of it. You know, I mean, where's the good in that? But then you go down there and maybe you do find something that's truly more authentic, and then you find out that your happiness can be based on other things.
Right. And, you know, for me, that was material objects, you know, letting go of a lot of my thoughts around capitalism and materialism. It got me in touch with the earth more. And it also gave me compassion for what people are experiencing now. because Pluto is going to be hitting everybody in stages as it goes through Capricorn, because a lot of us just are, maybe some of us have a heavy Capricorn or some sort of aspect to Pluto in our charts, and it might not hit until the end of, you know, the cycle near 23. And so for me, I'm finding, at least with this collective reckoning, I can have a lot of compassion watching people cling and watching the dissension happen and the finger pointing and the division, because we're all afraid of what's happening. Mm-hmm. And I could feel that in my own energy system, the victim. Oh, me, poor me, you know, how can I hold on to what I in the shame, it's all falling apart, how do I stop it? I have so much compassion now going after going through my own process. So I feel like I was kind of initiated to help others at this point and move forward as it starts amping up. When, you know, we've got climate change. So look at the loss with that when that starts escalating and, you know, people losing their homes and their communities.
There's such a play going on around us at this time. And we're in this time of abrupt climate change, increasing storms, floods, droughts, and unprecedented deluges that are just hitting, you know, unexpectedly. And how do we act in these times? You know, so you talk about these astrological archetypes, and we kind of see people polarizing themselves and kind of crystallizing into different formats. And I was wondering if you wanted to take a few moments to go through just a couple of the main ones that really affect consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the dynamics we're seeing right now is Saturn in Sagittarius. On a collective level, that is making us take a look at our religions. And it's bringing up the guru and maybe the dark guru, where, you know, people have become more of a narcissistic, I have the way. And so we're seeing also fundamentalism. It's bringing up fundamentalism for review. And so we're starting to see a lot of those dynamics happen. I think in order to make us shift that whole arena, you know, as far as spirituality and how we move forward as a one world, because religion can be very divisive. And I think Saturn has come in to make us get really logical and take a look at what's going on fundamentally in our religious and spiritual systems. And I think too, through that, we'll be seeing a lot of people being called out, and as we have seen. And so that's kind of a mini cycle right there. We also have Neptune in Pisces. Neptune's also a collective planet like Pluto. And Neptune is the mystic. It's something that connects us to a higher knowing and like a god, whatever you want to call it. And so it's in Pisces right now, which is also a very mystical sign. And it's very intuitive. It's very open and as far as sensing and sensitive. And so right now we're seeing a big shift into mysticism and people awakening to something greater than themselves. And that's where, when you play the two, like Pluto and Capricorn and Neptune and Pisces, we see the death of our systems, which are more individualistic, with an opening of more of a collective energy and how we're all connected. So I love how those dynamics work together, because all cycles work together in a continuum and they interplay. So it's not just about one cycle. So at the same time, while we're watching things destruct and fall apart, we're also seeing things open and become more connected. But in the middle of all that, we have chaos. And so some people are going to react in not so nice ways or negatively. And it's based on fear. And others will have to help hold a lot of energy for compassion and love and innovation. And so we're kind of seeing duality there. And it's such an interesting time. I don't like to ever look at it as either or, because if you get trapped into the destruction, you start getting depressed and hopeless. And so I'd like to see people focusing on the both and showing how can we be authentic moving forward, and how can we open up to a larger perspective and a larger connection. And that's what's happening across the world. Climate change, to me, is something that doesn't discriminate at all. And so it may be hitting areas that might be more poor or third world or whatever, and you could call that discrimination. But to me, climate change doesn't discriminate. We're all going to have to experience it together. And so how do we come together? It's a collective experience. And I think we can each feel the pain that can bring up, the fear that comes in of what's going to happen. And also in every country, in every part of the world, we can identify with this angst and this rebellion and this clinging to an old way.
You know, and our children, how do we raise them in the light of all of this chaos, I mean, unfolding around us? I mean, we've got the political situation and the outrage and the awakening and the rebellion about that. And then you've got abrupt climate change and death and rebirth and chaos. And how do you raise a child to be emotionally resilient in this time? And what values and feelings and drives can you instill into them to help them deal with these times that are ahead of us?
Oh, that's such a great question. And as a mother, I toy with it all the time. And my son's 14, and he is a typical teenager. He has his friends, he goes to school, he likes, what are those fidget things that are just coming out, So he has a typical, I would say, American perspective. But for me, I try to lead by example and talk about climate change a little bit. He's starting to push back, doesn't want to hear. And I think they all know on an unconscious level, the younger generation knows that these are going to be tough times going forward. And they're being raised and born into a system that's falling apart, but they're not being taught a new way to go forward. And so what I'd like to instill with him is resilience, is the importance of growing your own food, even if we don't do so right now, and the importance of maybe having a mobile home so that if the weather shifts or there's no water, he can move and survive. And these are conversations. I don't push it too much because he'll want to push back, but I plant the seeds for that. And to teach our kids, in our culture, we're so individualistic and competitive. And everybody has to stand out as special, and whether it's materialistically or being the best on their team or what their talents, whatever. And so I think what we need to really nurture in our young ones is a sense of community, which we have lost, and coming together, compassion. I try to, when my son might be talking about somebody, I try to talk with him about the flip side of what might be going on with that person. What's the unseen life going on with that person that we don't know about that might be influencing their behavior? How can we find compassion for someone so that we don't judge? I mean, the judge and overreaction these days is just off the charts. And we're pointing fingers, and that's based out of fear, basically. And I try to teach him that fear is a huge motivator of human actions and reactions, and how can we have compassion? And it doesn't mean you need to take abuse or anything like that, but how can we try to teach our kids to see a bigger picture and to try to flip the coin and see another side to the story? And I just try to train him to see both sides, whether the other side is true or not. I just try to have him practice that, because it's really important not to get tunnel vision in these times. Because there's so much going on. I think tunnel vision is what separates, and it becomes really about tribe versus tribe and my group versus your group and who's got the control at that point. And so I like to see parents and teachers and communities teaching more skills about not so much capitalistic survival and careers, but more about how do we connect in community? How can we try to see another side to a story and feel that, or feel the feelings of someone else and try to empathize with them and to try to see where they might be coming from? How do we listen in conversations how do we have conversations with all the toys and, you know, the computers and the iPhones and that sort of thing. It's really interesting to watch them, and they're stuck on their phones and they're connected in the same room playing the same game, but they're not interacting as people. And so teaching interpersonal skills, I think, is so huge right now, too.
Mm-hmm. I so agree. We get so involved with our cyber worlds that our cyber worlds become more real than our, you know, physical interacting with, you know, our friends and family. So that's very odd. Such times
when it's
we
gone. Yeah, what happens when it's gone? If, you know, with climate change, start losing services, these people are going to wake up and go, how do we interact?
No. No kidding. Hey, have you noticed in Hollywood how they kind of are precursors to things that happen? And have you noticed how many kind of post-apocalyptic movies have been coming out lately and things involving the shift and mm-hmm. a lot of exits and things like that? Do you want to talk a little bit about what your feelings are about that?
Oh, yeah, I totally agree. Hollywood is great. You can see it coming. And I think what's great about, well, and if you look at the psyche of an actor or a writer, somebody like that, is they're very open to collective energies and intuiting the future. And so they don't know they're doing it. They're doing it through, they're channeling it through their right brain and their creativity. And the intuitive mind is the right brain. So they're tapping into their right brain and bringing about basically what's on the wind psychically and in the unconscious. And so it's really great to watch these movies. I think it's wonderful in the sense that it'll help people start imagining what might happen in the future, at least imagining the energies around it, giving coping skills. You see the rebel, one of my favorites is Hunger Games. I just love Katniss.
I do too. Nothing like a woman with a bow.
I just got a bow and arrow for Mother's Day.
Did you really?
Yeah. My boyfriend bought me one. He saw it. He's like, oh, get her a bow and arrow. So I'm digging it. And it's such a great thing to identify with these movies. And I think that's why they are so popular and sell well, because we all know on an unconscious level what's going on, even if we can't articulate it, or sometimes we just don't know that we know. And same with mediumship skills, you know, with all these medium shows and Long Island Medium, and that's become more mainstream as well. And for me, I feel that it's partly because it's becoming more acceptable, and we're starting to see religious dogma break down around that genre. And at the same time, too, I think on a collective level, we feel that there are going to be big events where a lot of people are going to die. You know, we're going to have storms and earthquakes and just big collective events that are going to take a lot of people out. And I feel like people are wanting to know there's something on the other side. And where do we go from here? So I think that's one of the Hollywood things that's on the rise as well, because of that unconscious knowing that we all have.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I mean, if we're looking at extinction as a species, and it certainly looks that way to me, I don't see any big turnaround, and everything's exponentiating all over the place. So we're just looking mm-hmm. at the best time we're ever going to have ecologically wise right this minute, and it just keeps it's just deteriorating. So we're looking at extinction, and we're grappling with that, and it's causing all sorts of changes within us. But mm-hmm. what happens, you know you and I both are we believe in reincarnation and the continuity of consciousness and life after death, and that's just a personal thing that we've come to. So given that, what happens to the group soul of human consciousness? I mean, we've put a lot of work into this group collective of human consciousness, such that it is, you know, over thousands and thousands of years, you know, cultures come, mm-hmm. cultures rise, cultures fall. All these things have happened. We've had Egypt, we've had Sumeria, we've had all of these ancient cultures up until the present moment, and we're here right now, and we're watching it all fall apart. Completely, very finally, forever. What happens to this giant group soul of human consciousness? What is your feeling about that?
Oh, that's a big question. And can I answer it? I can get feelings around it, definitely.
And we don't have to say what will, but I mean, we have to give birth to these thoughts because this is like the next thought. You know, okay, you've come to extinction, you've come to this, you've come to that, and then you have to come to logically the next thought. That's the next thought. And maybe this isn't something that we come to on this show, but maybe this is just something that we kind of offer out and say, well, there's like this massive group consciousness of human awareness. What's going to go with that? Is it just finishing? Is it going on to something else?
I feel it's going on to something else. And the reason why I love this question too is because it does get us chewing on a bigger idea and getting us away from the devastation and trauma of extinction or climate change. And so when we're so focused on the demise and the destruction and the death, and we forget that something's being created, something's evolving. And so when something ends, something begins. And so whether it's on this planet or not is not the point. I feel like the human experience is us coming into a body so that we can evolve as a soul energetically. And whether that soul is on this planet or some other planet in the galaxy or just part of a collective energy, it doesn't matter. It's evolving. And so I feel that even if the human species is totally gone, that is part of an evolutionary process to raise a consciousness and to evolve our growth as a soul. Because each, and this is what I teach people when I work with them one-on-one, is we're usually fighting ourselves because of what culture and maybe our parents or whatever, and our authenticity is not being reflected. And I think part of coming into a human soul or human body as a soul is to bring that authenticity, and our growth on this planet, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, is part of the process of revealing the soul and having our individual souls evolve and move forward, and then as well as the collective soul doing the same. So I feel like when we come to Earth, it's just part of our consciousness, and it might be two different types of consciousness tied into a greater consciousness. So we have our individual thing going on, and then we have a greater consciousness, and it all feeds in as one. And I feel like with climate change and it's in particular, it's a great way for us to connect because no one is immune from it on this planet. We can't escape it. And so it is a collective event. And we can't just say it's Russia or it's China, it's all of us. And so we're going to have to experience this together and evolve through it together, whether it's on this planet or in some other realm. And in my work as a medium, I don't know how it works. I just know I can pass on messages. You know, I don't know where they are. I just get thoughts in my head and I pass messages on. It's confirmed. And it's kind of like its own source, like an internet. It's like email, you know? I can't see the email going, but I can pass the message through. So, you know, there's different dimensions and there's different realities. And it's not just about this physical earth plane. And I feel like when we get too attached to that is where the suffering can also happen. We can be a part of it, be part of the world, and enjoy the beauty and feel all the pain and have that human experience. But when we're attached to it, I feel like that's where the suffering comes from and where we are starting to see a lot of suffering on a political level and economic level because we're so attached to these systems. And that's why I think Pluto again has to come through, break them down so that we can evolve beyond that.
So well said. And I agree, this is a time where we can choose to polarize very strongly into shadow type things and fight off the inevitable, or we can open to our greater spirit and try and experience this with the background of love.
Most definitely. Most definitely.
So, you know, it's been an honor and such a pleasure to catch up with you finally.
Yes, it's been great to see your face here.
Yes.
Even though we're just going to be on audio for the show. But
well, yes, most people just know our voices, but now we've seen each other's faces, and it's pretty fun. We're both Colorado girls, so.
Yes, not too far away from each other.
Not too far, and someday we will get together for that lunch, I promise you.
Yes, we will.
Well, Lisa, thank you so much for a wonderful interview here at Extinction Radio, and be well in all you do. Well,
thank you so much, Jennifer. It's been a pleasure.